This is a production of Cornell University.
So we'll go ahead and get started. We'll call this meeting to order at 5:34. So first of all, thank you for checking your email and being here. Welcome to all our new members, our new field reps, and welcome back to our voting members and our previous members. So welcome. We hope the semester is going as smoothly as possible, given the current circumstances. But my name is Andy Barrientos Gomez. I am a fifth year now in Romance Studies, and I am the current GPSA president. And I'll pass it over to Alexa so she can introduce herself. And I know she's having some technological problems, which doesn't allow her to have her camera on. But we can probably hear her mic.
Yeah, self-inflicted technological problems. Make sure your water bottle is closed all the way when you put it in your backpack, just a thought. Hi, my name is Alexa Cohn. I'm a fourth-year PhD candidate in the microbiology department. I'm currently the executive vice president, and I've been involved in GPSA for 3 years now. This is my second year, or I guess this is my third year on the executive board.
Yeah,
technically.
And we also have our vice president of communications who is in the law school and has a class going on right now, so he's not able to join us, but his name is Taylor Tejeda, just so you are aware that we do have a vice president of communications. So we'll go ahead and get started with roll call. So Alexa, can you make sure that people are here, please?
Yeah, do you want me to share my screen or?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, let me do that. Okay. So from Arts and Humanities, is Paul here? I don't believe so. Hannah Cole, Stephanie Lopez, Marchik, I see, is here. Madeline is not here. Tim? No. Casey Laurent? Jordan Dutzel? I know Cody's here. Emery's here.
Yep, here.
Matt Schoffler, you're here as well, correct?
Yes.
Sorry, I'm like searching in the participation.
He is also here, yep.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Heidi? And Matthew Sturgeon is not here. Allison? Peyton? Ryan Maloney? Ding Wan? Meredith, Sean, Hannah, yes, I see Hannah, bring it there. Ruth, yes, is here. Karina, not, I do not see her.
I'm here.
Oh, you're here? What is your name on Zoom? Because I'm not seeing it come up.
It's the picture with a hat and glasses. Marina Mann.
Oh, sorry. I was calling Karina Barris.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry. You're fine. You're fine. Mila. Catherine Masters. Ethan Call. All right.
Thank you.
That's
one. It's a good thing we don't have any business today.
I was just thinking that.
we wouldn't have quorum. But what we do have are some guest speakers, which we will get to in a minute. Before that, let's quickly approve the minutes for, I'm on full screen, for April 6th of last semester. So are there any changes to the minutes, any amendments that people would like to make? And if you do, please raise your hand, your virtual hand under participants, and Alexa will call on you. Okay. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes as is?
Motion to approve the minutes as is.
Okay, there's been a second. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, okay. The minutes pass as is. The minutes for April 6th. Okay, now we will move on to our second part of the of this meeting, which is our presentations. And today we have Dr. Charlie Van Loan, which is the Dean of Faculty, and Dr. Nima Kudva, the Associate Dean of Faculty. And they are here to talk about the Code of Academic Integrity and other ways that the GPSA members can get involved. After that, we'll have Gina Giambattista, the Director of Office of the Assemblies, who will talk about shared governance. But for now, let's give Dr. Charlie Van Loan and Dr. Nima Kudva our full undivided attention.
Right, can we get the slides up on the screen?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm working on it right now, sorry.
Okay, I can start talking anyway. So actually there's two parts. There's a part on academic integrity. We have three changes we'd like to make to the code. And then another very important issue that we want to make sure the GPSA is well informed about is what we're calling the anti-racist initiative, which was prompted by the president in a message that went out over the summer. So I'll talk about the AI stuff, and then Nima will give you an overview of the initiative.
Alexa, I think I could maybe find it here. I already have them up. Do you want me to share them?
Yeah, it's opening right now, my computer. Sorry. It's going right now. Okay.
I'll go ahead and I think.
You got it? Okay.
I got it. There we go. It was ready to go. Okay, Charlie, let me know when you're ready for me to change slides.
Okay, next slide. So, this activity started over the summer, and it was prompted by experiences in the spring semester. We worked on this with a few colleagues over the summer, and then the Senate now received basically the same presentation you're getting last week. So, in a nutshell, the three proposed changes have to do with, and I'll describe these in detail. Replacing the independent witness with a video, okay? The second one is a method for handling large cases. And the third thing has to do with SU and grade change options. I just wanna say one thing here. If you click on any of those links, you'll be taken to a webpage where there's more detail and you can post comments, okay? Which is very important. Next slide, please. So here's the approval process. And the first one, we thought we'd go through these sequentially, but because we sort of ran out of time, but also it's good to handle it all in parallel at the same time. So the groups that we wanted to especially hear from include the faculty who staff the college hearing boards, the judicial codes counselors who are law students who worked with students to ensure that the process is fair. And of course, we want to hear from you and the undergraduates. We have a committee called the Educational Policy Committee that's gathering all this feedback. There are rough drafts of these resolutions on the website, and the feedback is about concerns with them and modifications with them. So the timeline sort of goes like this. Maybe in 2 or so weeks, the EPC is going to look at all the feedback, reshape the resolutions, and then send them to the Senate. we'll probably just post these at our next meeting, which is September 16. And so wait, no, September, I've lost track of September 30, sorry, is the next meeting. And then we'll vote on them the meeting after that, which is October 14. Okay, so that's where we are. Let's now talk about these three proposals. Next slide, please. So because we're all online, primary hearings, which is where the faculty member presents the evidence and the student has a chance to respond, the way we normally do business when it's a physical meeting is that in the room is what's called a independent witness, basically a note taker who just makes sure that everything is going according to the rules. And if there's an appeal and there are disputes, then the notes and so on can be used to resolve things. The fact is now that we're doing this on Zoom, and you can have a video recording of the entire proceedings. And the idea here then is that instead of having an independent witness, we would rely on the Zoom recording. This, in case, a big issue in this whole area is the extreme time it takes to process these cases. And with this device will then sort of halve the workload in a way, at least in terms of the wall clock time that you have to have a person in the room at the same time. So the idea is it's a more accurate rendition of the meeting, and you save some labor as well. Next slide, please. So here are some of the concerns that came up. One is, who has the recording? Clearly, security is a very important thing. When should it be expunged? Who has access to it? There was also a concern that with so much detail then being in the video that one little misstep can create a legal problem and so on. But anyway, the basic feedback, and I'm just relaying what my reading of what the concerns that were posted on our website and the Senate reaction last week, basically people are okay with this. The one concern came from the fact that people didn't understand what the independent witness is. The student and the faculty member, for that matter, can have a witness, a character witness or a witness who can shed light on the case and so on. That doesn't change at all. Okay, so there was concern that with one less person in the room, that the more opportunity for things to not be done properly. That is not the case. Students are allowed to bring witnesses to the meeting, and so can the faculty member. So anyway, that's the first proposal. Second, let's go to the second one. There were some extremely large cases last semester. I mean, we've had large cases before. But if you have a case that involves 50 students, say, because of some online cheating situation, it's actually impossible for the faculty member to go through all, say, 50, 60, or maybe up to 100 primary hearings. They each take at least a half an hour. And the idea then is that if you have a large case, and the definition of large now is more than three students, that the instructor has the option of delegating their role in the primary hearing to a member of the staff or faculty. It would have to be approved by the chair. The faculty member still makes the decision. They would have the Zoom recording to go over things if necessary. But the idea here then is to delegate the role of the instructor to someone else in the primary hearing, but with enough checks to make sure it's done properly. Okay, so there were concerns about this. Let's look at the next slide and see what they were. So first of all, these hearings often have a really strong educational value. Simply the face-to-face meeting between the instructor and the student has a very important impact. So that would be lost at first glance if we go to this system. However, one of the things is maybe not on the slide, but we want to make an adjustment to that, which is that after that, if the student wants to have a face-to-face meeting, they're entitled to it. It's just that to handle the bulk of a large number of cases, we would have this option. The judicial codes counselors who have studied all our processes very carefully had an issue with this. And let me sort of get back to this thing about the distance between the student and the instructor. In many universities, the processing of cases is done by an independent office. In other words, the faculty member would just package up the evidence, it would go to this office, the hearing would take place there, and so on. And that's an attractive setup for several reasons. One is in terms of saving time for the faculty member. The other one is that the faculty member is then not the judge and jury. Right? In our system, the faculty member presents the evidence, there's a discussion, and then decides on the sanction if necessary. And it's in looking at this proposed change, the JCCs sort of liked it. However, hoping it could sort of turn into this thing where the faculty member just presents the evidence and is not the judge. Okay, so. I'm probably not being super clear, but maybe in the questions afterwards, I could clarify that. So anyway, there was concern again about due process here. But in general, the consensus is my reading is that if we have these safeguards, in other words, if the student can request a face-to-face meeting with the instructor, it would be okay. Let's see, we're going in the wrong direction. Okay, let's go to the last, yes, okay. So now the question is, suppose an SU student is found guilty of a charge. Now a standard sanction might be to reduce your final grade by a letter grade or half a letter grade or something like that. But of course, if you're SU, you don't have any wiggle room that way. If you're gonna change the grade, it'll go to you. So the thing here now is let's get some flexibility so that we can have a more just sort of penalty, because going to a U may not be justified. But let's look at the criticisms. The criticisms had to do with, the proposal was that the faculty member could on their own have the grade option changed to letter and then give the sanction that they felt was deserving. Can I have the next slide, please? Yeah, so the pushback was basically the student should be involved in that decision. In other words, it should not be that the faculty member can all of a sudden say, you're going to a letter grade and here's gonna be your reduced grade and so on. The student should be engaged in that decision. So basically, it might be something of the form, do you want a U or some reduced letter grade? In other words, engage the student in the choice, if they want to exercise it, of going to a letter grade. As you know, U means no credit, and that might be something that's unacceptable to the student, whereas going to a letter grade and you would still get credit, for example. We checked with the registrars about these things because, and it would have to be done manually. There's a little complaining that it would, it's manual, it'll take up time. But compared to the time that is spent doing these hearings, it's really not a significant amount of time. And it's not like there's millions of these cases anyway. So again, with this proviso that the student is involved in the change of the grade option, there seem to be widespread support for that. Okay, I'm gonna stop right now, and we'll have time for questions here, but I wanna stress something. Again, there are three web pages where these are described in detail. You'll see feedback that's been posted. You'll see links to the Senate discussion. And we very much want to hear from you. First of all, many of you are TAs, so you have seen these things up close. You are also students who may be on the receiving end of this. But just being in academics, you, I'm sure, have a strong sense of what's proper and correct, and also an appreciation for the academic integrity problem that is a major issue. Okay, that's it. I'm not sure how you handle who moderates. Maybe Andy, if you want to, if there are any raised hands there, just call on people and we're happy to answer questions.
Sure. Thank you, Charlie. If at any point you need me to bring up the PowerPoint, let me know. So right now we're opening it up to questions. So if you do have a question, please raise your virtual hand under the participants. By now we should all be experts at Zoom, hopefully. And Alexa will call on you, and please only ask your question when you are called on by Alexa. So do we have any questions so far? I don't see any. Actually, let me check. I don't see any. So would you like to move on to the next portion of the presentation?
Yeah, and let me just again stress, you can post comments anonymously on our website. And if something comes to your mind, again, if we can hear from you within a week, that would be excellent. And of course, please share these proposals or the slides or whatever with your colleagues. Okay, so we'll now continue with the second half of the presentation, which has to do with what we're calling the Anti-Racism Initiative. And so it has three parts. And Nima, who's Associate Dean for faculty, will give the overview presentation. So Nima.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Andy, for having us here, and Alexa and everybody else. So as you know, President Pollock, after the murder of George Floyd, you know, sent a note out to the community outlining some actions that that she, you know, sort of announced that Cornell would be taking. And then in that, it was also announced that some of these actions would be within the purview of the Faculty Senate. And so Charlie and I have been working with our colleagues to really begin to imagine what this is going to look like, and we wanted to share that with you. So the next slide, please. So there were five pieces to President Pollock's kind of announcement that the faculty would look at, and three of those pieces are what we've really taken up to take forwards in these coming months. So we've been working quite hard on it, actually. The two pieces that are not included here, one is a themed semester, which, you know, given this semester, is not possible to really kind of even come to grips with. And then there's another part that has to do with the way program review and everything happens within the university. So we won't be talking about that here. So these three parts are an educational requirement for students. In her message, it seemed to imply that it was mostly undergraduate students, but we, of course, have expanded that to include all our students, you know, graduate research students, professional students, as well as all our doctoral students. So the whole conversation about whether this has to be, how it's going to be structured, who delivers it. I mean, there's a lot of issues. And as you might all know, except for the swim test, Cornell has no requirement that comes out of the center. And so there's a lot of debate around how one can even do that. And Charlie and I think that there is a bylaw somewhere, we can dig and find it, which puts the swim test, for example. We know that the swim test sits under the Senate for some reason. And so we have to figure that one out. So there's an educational requirement for students. So the content of it, the structure of it, the form of it is something that we have to think about. There is also an educational requirement for faculty. And where and how one delivers that is an even bigger challenge than thinking about an educational requirement for students. And then the third part, of course, is this notion of a center. And center, as Charlie always says, and I've learned to echo it, is really in our mind a placeholder. It's not a building, it's not a structure. It doesn't have form yet, but it is something, right? It could be a network, it could be a form, it could be a forum, it could be an existing program that gets a certain kind of expansion to it. We don't know yet because this conversation hasn't, you know, has only just started. But this placeholder for this thing, the way we've imagined it to so far is that it's a vibrant intellectual force on this campus for sort of, you know, for work that is focused on anti-racism, belonging, equity, questions of that sort, and that it'll also provide, you know, we think right now, some kind of internal oversight and external visibility. Next slide, please. So I want to talk a little bit more about the work actually that has gone into elaborating what this program is going to look like, or what our process is going to look like. So we started by this commitment to build on the work of others, and by really wanting to understand what Cornell has done as an institution over the years in order to meet these sorts of, you know, sort of diversity and belonging and inclusion kind of you know, goals, right? Now, Cornell, clearly, for those of you know, you've heard enough of the stories, we had a very egalitarian start. And then we've, you know, as with all institutions, you know, we've run into a lot of trouble and friction trying to actually build on the promise of that egalitarian start. And there was, the takeover of Willard Strait is something that everybody knows about in 1968. So what we started to do was to look at every task force report, committee report on race, belonging, curricula, in this, and from that period on till 2020. We're putting together all these reports, and what is striking is that these three demands for an educational requirement for faculty, for students, and for centers, or a center, depending on which report you look at, are pretty consistent over the years. You know, so for us, the real interest in looking at this is to understand what the institution has been able to do, what kinds of initiatives have they been able to launch, and what have they not been able to do? What are the kinds of failures that we've had over the years, and why is that? So we hope then to understand how to not sort of create a set of policies that is going to sink in the same ways in which, you know, many of these other programs did. Though I must also point out, you know, that we've achieved a lot, right? In 1968, when the first report came out, we had 4 students who were African-American. Today, almost like 12% of our student body is undergraduates, not graduate students. And so it's you know, so there is a great URMs, not just African-Americans. And so there is a great deal of change, but it's not enough. So next slide. Our other commitment is to build on current strengths. So we have a range of programs majors for undergraduates, but programs, departments, units at this university that have done and are continuing to do some amazing work around questions of around race, equality, diversity, belonging, all these kinds of different issues, right? And there's amazing strength amongst the faculty in terms of research, amazing graduate students, you know, amongst the, you know, I'm sure there's some of you are sort of in these, associated with these programs here on this call. And so we want to be able to build on those strengths, not say, yeah, anyway, so that's pretty much what that is about. Our process in terms of reaching out is we took the initial list that was in Preston Pollock's email and then did an open call through the Senate and have kept building this list of units across campus who want to be part of the conversation, who want to kind of be actively involved in creating, in working on those three initiatives. Next slide, please. So the center, like I said, is a placeholder, and we really need to kind of keep refining what it is. And so, you know, there's some ideas there. The real piece, though, for us about the center is that the three inform each other. So, you know, just as an example, think about the Society for Humanities, right? Every person who comes into the Society for Humanities, a postdoctoral scholar or a regular scholar, like an academic from another university or one of our departments, they are required to teach a course So they're fulfilling both a research function around a topic that they apply for these grants, but they also teach. So we want to think about this relationship between these three pieces, the two educational requirements and this placeholder for a center, in similar kinds of ways, to build on another. The phrase of anti-racism is also for us a placeholder. In the conversations we've already started to have with the American, American Indigenous and Studies program, that's what it is. As some of you might know about this, this idea of decolonization becomes really quite important. So racism is one part of it. I mean, how do we think about minoritized populations? How do we think about who got stripped of what kinds of rights, especially in the United States, which is a settler colony? And then to expand on that notion, not to the point where it loses efficacy, but to be inclusive enough of those populations that were enslaved and dispossessed. So that's one part of it, right? So then there's the climate part of, in the institution. Do we have the kind of climate that allows people to thrive, to really belong here? That's one part of it. And then the other part of it is our disciplines, right? And this, of course, for those of you who are in the humanities, this has been very much a part of the conversation for some time. The sciences are also beginning to see this, right? Look at the rash of articles we've had recently on cancer researchers where we only look at white bodies. Dermatologists who don't know how to read dark skin. And so, it goes on and on and on. If you're in business, there's this wonderful book that's come out which looks at accounting practices and how modern accounting practices are completely tied up in how slaveholders managed plantations and their enslaved laborers. And so you have a lot of work, right, that's being done within disciplinary frames to really begin to decolonize our disciplines. And we want that to be as much a part of whatever this thing is going to become as is the other anti-racist work that's kind of talked about quite a bit. Okay, next slide, please. So the last bit here is that we are very conscious of sort of, thinking about the question of accountability. I talked about it a little bit earlier, right? We've seen successes, but we've also seen a lot of failures, and we want to understand why that's happening. And our first read from all this sort of historical work that we've been looking at, institutional work that we've looked at historically, is that the accountability metrics and measures are really weak. And so there isn't a way in which to hold ourselves and the institution accountable for the kinds of programs and policies we want to be put in place, right? For what we want to see happen. So we really want to be quite conscious of that and to keep building on the data and on the assessment data that we, Cornell collects masses of information. And so we want to be able to do that. And to, so if you look at this slide more carefully, it's a very careful kind of a mapping of all the different surveys we have and who does what and how we want to be, we want to be looking at this as well. So next slide. Charlie, do you want to do this part?
Sure. Okay, yeah.
Okay. So Charlie will talk more about the sort of required educational program, because that's the piece of that triad that we've worked the most, that we're furthest ahead on.
Okay, so next slide. So here's some attributes or some facts that we have to deal with. So first of all, the idea is to propose some kind of four-credit requirement. Doesn't have to be a single course, but some kind of requirement. And of course, the topics, the scope of the requirement is sort of, we sort of roughly know what it is, but that has to be refined. But here's a fact of life, which is that students and faculty are booked up, the former with course requirements, degree requirements, the latter with commitments to research, teaching, and service. So how do you find a way to slot in a requirement given that? There's some, I'm talking more on the undergrad side here for a moment. There are some programs on campus that are perhaps relevant to this effort. One is the Intergroup Dialogue Project, which is an orientation activity. We have the freshman writing seminars, Engage Cornell, and the colleges are all working on various requirements. So these are all the ingredients that have to be fed into the discussion. Next slide, please. If this requirement involves a menu, then yeah, that's sort of a realistic thing. But menus require work, menus require criteria, and then it starts getting complicated. So if you have a menu system, you have to deal with those aspects. Finally, and this is good that we're here at the GPSA, which is, although the tone sort of has been in the discussion of the requirement very undergraduate centric, the issue then becomes what should a requirement look like for graduate and professional students? The content would surely be similar, but the delivery system would have to be totally different. At the undergrad level, we're dealing with 6 colleges. That's hard enough, of course. At the grad level, you know, we have maybe 100 different degree programs with a fair level of autonomy. So it's very much on the agenda to figure out how to do this at the graduate and professional student level. Next slide, please. Next slide. Okay, so for faculty, as Nima said, the challenge is even sort of greater. So just a couple of things. So one piece, there are lots and lots of programs out there that the Office of Faculty Development and Diversity has put together. And so no question that a lot of that is relevant to some kind of requirement. But missing in all that is accountability. So that is something we want to pay attention to. And there are two critical points at the faculty level where this where there's some interesting possibilities. One, of course, is at the time of promotion. You can think tenure, but all promotions are an occasion where you look at the candidate. And the question then is, we have a committee that oversees the whole tenure process. Are there ways, for example, of heightening the profile of student letters in the dossier so that, say, systematic bias is caught and so on? So that's something we're going to look at. Another important point when it comes to accountability is at the department level. Every 7 or 8 or 9 years, every academic unit is evaluated in great detail. And that might be an occasion where you really hold a department accountable. Maybe there's some misconduct. A question to pose to the department during the review might be, what do you do about it? Okay. So we're looking into accountability and at these two particular critical points. Next slide, please. So just a quick step of synopsis of where we are right now. There are going to be ad hoc committees for each of these 3 initiatives. We're in the process of setting them up. This involves selecting faculty, but it also involves selecting students. An initial plan might be that for every faculty member on a committee, they have a student buddy or whatever who can sit in on any meeting and be very much part of the conversation. We're working with these 2 Senate committees on the accountability thing, and also to figure out sort of the scope of this whole initiative. We're talking to lots of groups, a lot of one-on-ones, just to get a sense of what the center should do and how it should do it. So I'm thinking that within the next week or two, we should be well on our way to staffing these committees. As Nima mentioned, there's kind of a staggered start. The student requirement thing is a little more tractable, and that will probably be rolled out first. Anyway, we really want to make headway on this, and with some very concrete suggestions that will go to the Senate. These committees will work on the problem, they will research the problem, they'll make a proposal, they will show up in the Senate with resolutions to do X, Y, or Z. The Senate will debate those, perhaps modify them, and the Senate has no authority to do some of these things, especially if resources are involved. It then goes to the President and the Provost for enactment. Okay? Things like the educational requirement that may not involve extra resources, could simply be enacted through Senate legislation. anyway, that's the overview. The key thing is we really want everybody on campus to pay attention and to track these events. We have a website that's just being built up right now. We'll make it easy for you to track the work of these committees and to comment on them. What we want to avoid is the standard way of doing business, which goes something like this. You know, you roll out, Blue Ribbon Task Force, big fanfare, Cornell Chronicle article, then you have like 4 or 5 months of radio silence, then there's some kind of final report, another big fanfare. We don't want that. We want total transparency from start to finish. We want everyone to be engaged in this because the problems are incredibly complex and we need as many people working on them and commenting on them as possible. So this was a giant heads up, but we think it's a pretty important heads up and look forward to interacting with you in the months to come. Questions for Nima and me on that part?
Thank you, Charlie. Before we go to the speakers list, we did have a previous question from Hannah, which she says that from the first portion of your presentation, Charlie, she agrees that all of those are good points and that they should be incorporated. But are you looking for grad students to agree or reinforce feedback? So Hannah, you might, if you want to chime in to clarify that question, that would be great. Unless you can take it from here, Charlie.
Well, it's a pretty clear question. You can see what's been posted on the website. In other words, the proposals are very clear. Some of them have flaws in them that have since been addressed. If you want to reinforce what's written there, that's absolutely fine. If you see something different that isn't posted there, please share your insights. So that's sort of where things stand. So, yeah.
The points that you brought up in terms of feedback, are you planning to incorporate all of them?
So for example, the original proposal on the grade change thing said the faculty member can just do it. Excellent feedback was that the student should be a co-decision, but the student should have the chance to choose. So that was a change that will most definitely be incorporated. The matter sits with our Educational Policy Committee, who will digest all the suggestions. But by and large, they were fairly well received, except for those isolated points. But I think we've addressed those changes. But it's up for the EPC now to digest all that and come to the Senate with their best recommendation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Alexa. You can take over the speakers list, and we have two questions.
Yeah, the first one I see is Martek.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Charlie. Thanks for the presentation. I was just curious if Cornell has allocated any form of monetary or financial budget for these anti-racism plans at all or not.
So I asked the president when we started this, I said, how much should we get into resources? So for example, let's take the center and maybe an example. Maybe you think some kind of postdoc program should be part of that. Well, I think the committees in the Senate should do a rough analysis about that. But the president sort of said, clearly you want to be realistic, okay? But focus on the ideas. The resources thing is a piece that the president and the provost would act on. It's not like they said you have X hundred thousand, X million dollars, now figure out the best thing to do with that. It's not like that. It's just figure out the best thing to do and then and pay attention to resources. But we don't have to get down to the dollars and cents. In other words, be realistic. But then that's a matter for the president and the provost and the deans to work out.
I have one more question.
Can we go to the next one and you can answer, do a follow-up question after?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. So Jeff?
Hi, Charlie and Nima. Thanks for the presentation. I have two questions, but I'll wait for the second one later on the speakers list. You had mentioned about the departmental review as a potential way to address accountability for faculty. Mm-hmm. Are there any other ideas specifically for tenured faculty in terms of this? Because it seems like the other option was more for the tenure progression process as opposed to those who already are past that point.
Okay, good point. So first, when you think about promotions for faculty for on the tenure track, then of course, the assistant to associate is the very big deal, but there's also associate to full professor, which is a big deal, but not as big, of course, as the tenure thing. But then we also have other tracks. You know, there's the lecturer track, there's the professor of the practice track. So all promotions are an occasion when where accountability can surface or as a criteria. So it's not just the tenure track thing. And chairs are the people who deal with this. In other words, stuff happens. Maybe there's a formal process, 6.3, 6.4, 1.2 is research misconduct. The chair has to act on these things with sanctions and so on. And so you could simply require the department, you could sort of pose this question during an extensive review, which is, how have you handled these things? Okay. And that would force departments to pay more attention to this and to have real consequences for the faculty that where there's misconduct. So that's how that would sort of work. It's not just that tenure faculty are not totally insulated from these things, right? So it's more difficult in those cases sometimes when you get into extreme sanctions, but it really applies to all promotions across any faculty track.
But just to chime in, Charlie, so Jeff, I do think, so Charlie's right. The first 15 years of a faculty member's sort of stay, 12 to 15 years, gets taken up with this, right? You have like the you're going in for tenure and then going up for promotion to full. After that, it actually kind of gets a little harder. And we've talked quite a bit about this. And there are other ways, but to start to get to this question of unethical behaviors. And it has very much to do with our reporting systems. It has to do with how chairs actually interact with their faculty members. And so the university has an entire system by which chairs who are faculty from, within the same department, by which chairs are, there's a training that the university does for new chairs. And so that's where some of this comes in. So what we have to do is to really look for the levers that we can use in order to be able to have some kind of an accountability mechanism. But you're very right in that sort of after year 12, 13, it gets a little harder for us to figure out the most effective way. It's not as easy, but we have to do it. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, thank you.
So I do want to be mindful of time. We are very behind on the agenda and we still have another speaker and some other business to get to it. So if I could advise Jeff and Martique to email our questions to our guest speakers, that would be great. We can write down your emails, Charlie and Nima, and they can get a hold of you there. But we really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Yes, definitely. If you could type in your emails, that way we can direct them there. Thank you. Usually clap at the end, but it's kind of harder. Thank you, David.
I can just do this.
Yeah, right. We have the virtual claps. So thank you very much. So we'd like to move on to the next portion of the agenda, which is the director of the Office of the Assemblies, who does a ton of work for us. And this is Gina Giambattista. And Gina's going to talk to us about shared governance and where the GPSA falls under that umbrella. So Gina, it's the floor is yours.
Very good. Thank you so much, Andy and Alexa. Thank you for having me here. I have a brief presentation about the history of shared governance at Cornell, some of the particulars about the GPSA, and then we'll get into a very, very brief overview about Robert's Rules of Order, just so that you have some framework for how the assembly manages its business during a meeting. So I'm going to share my screen. And first I have to do this. Hold on. There we go. Okay, so now can you see my screen?
Yes.
Are you seeing only my screen or my presenter screen? I'm never quite sure.
Presenter screen.
Uh-oh, okay.
Now we can see the full screen.
Okay, very good, thank you. So, this quote is sort of, it was a great starting point because shared governance sort of, it means something if you have an idea about shared governance, but if you don't, then it's sort of, it's the entry point to what we're talking about. So I'm gonna do a little bit of a deep dive into this. So the faculty have a senate, as Charlie and Nima have just described, and the students and the staff have assemblies. And like legislative bodies in our government, the assemblies are elected, representative, constituent bodies with some amount of delegated authority to affect, direct, or recommend policies to the highest levels of in our case, the university. Shared governance is a term we use broadly to include the assemblies, the faculty senate, and the constituent elected trustees. And so prior to 1955, the responsibility for making decisions regarding academic as well as non-academic policies and procedures fell to the faculty. And as was, as Nima referenced in their presentation, the events in 1969 on campus were actually the impetus for the what we call the modern assemblies. So Cornell shared governance bodies are a direct outgrowth of that unrest. The picture that you see there is actually a mass meeting of over 7,000 students camped out in Barton Hall for 3 days following the 1969 takeover of Willis Straight Hall to discuss conditions on campus. And outcomes of this event were the assemblies, the university ombudsman, the campus code of conduct, and the student elected trustee. So Cornell, about the trustee, Cornell is one of relatively few institutions in the nation allowing our campus community to directly elect constituent members to its highest governing body. The election for the student elected trustee was put on hold in the spring due to the COVID situation. And I'm actually very pleased to announce that there will be an extension of that election. Details will be coming out in the next few days, but we will be engaging the graduate and professional student community to participate in that so that we have a robust contested election this fall. So we'll be sending more information out about that hopefully in the next week. So the Cornell community, as you can see, every member of the Cornell community has representation in shared governance. The staff, the graduate professional students, undergraduates, faculty, and unique to Cornell is the university assembly, which takes up issues of common interest to all members of the Cornell community and does have place for 5 grad and professional students. The structure. So the assemblies, like the faculty senate, receive their authorities from the board of trustees. The assembly's authority includes recommending changes to university policies that affect constituents subject to the approval of the president, who reviews and responds to all resolutions passed by the assemblies. The office of the assemblies. So what do we do? Well, we are, myself, Wendy Treat, who is her moniker is right now Office of the Assemblies, and our new clerk, the Grad and Professional Student Assembly, is Corel Fasano, who's also, he's one of the little screens. And We provide support to all the assemblies, their committees. We maintain the public record. We help maintain the processes, elevate, promote, and encourage participation in shared governance. We support all campus elections, and we manage a lot of data and data sets. We work closely with the registrar and HRIS to have current, correct data sets for all of our constituents for mailings and elections. And what do we do for you? For the GPSA, we support the GPSA and your committees. We maintain a website with tools for the members of the assemblies and your committees. And we're here to serve as a resource for any matters related to the GPSA, the assemblies, or shared governance in general. We work very closely with the committee chairs and particularly with the executive committee. The legislative authority of the assemblies, as I mentioned, it originates from the president. The assemblies have advisory authority. The assemblies can make recommendations which are reviewed by the president in consultation with senior staff. And there is some senior staff changes going on in the grad school. So we'd be sure to make sure that everybody has fluid channels of communication. So specifically, the legislative authority of the grad and professional student assembly is, is to the graduate school and the non-academic policies. So all assemblies are ruled by your governing documents. Some may be changed internally, some require the approval of the president, but these are your documents. There's processes to change them, amend them, table them, but you are ruled by these. So we work very closely with the assembly to make sure that as you make any changes, those are reflected on the website so that you always have access to your most current documents. So that's about the legislative history and the history of shared governance. I'm going to do a very quick primer on Robert's Rules of Order. So who was he? Well, the original edition, as you can see, was published in 1876 by U.S. Army Brigadier General who had a bad experience leading a church meeting. So contentious issues happen all over. He wasn't even in a military meeting. This happened in church. So Robert's Rules of Order is a set of rules for conduct at meetings that allows everyone to be heard and allows the assembly to make decisions without confusion. And with sensitivities to those members who are less comfortable with speaking up, and in an effort to engage those to whom elected roles may be new, the use of Robert's Rules of Order ensures there's space at the table for all voices, the loud and the quiet. The role of the chair is to moderate the debate unless they're engaged in the issue or resolution, in which case the role of the moderator and authority of chair moves to the executive vice chair until the matter is settled and the vote is taken. A motion is a proposal that the assembly can take a certain action or that it expresses itself as holding a certain view. A motion has to be seconded, it is then debated, and then voting takes place. When you're debating your motions, it's important to listen to the other side, to focus on the issues and not the personalities, avoid questioning motives, and be polite. Types of voting. A roll call vote is most common. You'd vote for it, against it, or you can abstain. And an abstention is usually only if there's a distinct conflict of interest. Other voting type is unanimous consent. And for certain motions, the chair may simply ask the assembly if there's any objection. And if no member objects, then the motion passes. So the legislative process. If you are involved in writing a resolution, a few things to do as you're developing that. You develop the initiative, search for legislative history surrounding the issue, solicit feedback from assembly members and your constituents, and engage the stakeholders for information. Stakeholders can be your colleagues, your classmates, administrators, staff colleagues, assembly committees, or even the community, depending on the topic. This is just a brief checklist, things that you should do as you're developing your legislation. Check for the legislative history, check for peer institutions, maybe they've taken up the issue. make sure it's presented at all relevant committees, solicit the feedback from relevant university offices, have support from as many members as possible. And by then, if the issue is still unresolved, then begin to consider drafting the resolution. And at the point at which you do draft a resolution, the recommendation is by this point, you should have a pretty good idea of how the debate and vote will go before your resolution goes to the floor, so that the assembly has heard it before. It can engage in a proper debate on the floor and be processed accordingly, so that there's been plenty of time to promulgate the idea and really get it through to the assembly. That's the brief overview. Thank you very much for letting me have this time to do this, and I'll be happy to take any questions if anybody has any.
Thank you, Gina. Again, we'll open it up to questions. So if you have a question, please use the raise hand feature or email us in the chat and we'll ask your question on your behalf. So are there any questions? And please wait for Alexa to call on you.
I don't see any.
Go ahead.
I said I didn't see any questions.
Okay, last call for questions.
We're here all night long. If you have any questions, certainly, typically we'd say stop on by. We'd love to see you in the office, but send us an email either to Wendy Correll or myself. We'd be happy to answer any questions or go into further detail on any of the processes. And thank you for your participation in the assembly.
Thank you, Gina. And if I'm not mistaken, the email that they can reach you at is assemblies@cornell.edu. Assembly.
Yes. And we'll put it in the chat. Thank you.
Yes. I think Wendy already did that. So thank you very much.
Andy, you're muted.
Sorry. Thank you. Thank you for letting me know. Next, we'd like to move on to the next portion of the agenda, which is division breakout. In a traditional meeting, this is where we would caucus and go with our own divisions. For today, we're not going to do that. Instead, this will be your sign-in check-in point, and Alexa will tell you how to do that. So Alexa, the floor is yours.
Sorry, I'm just shortening the link. Okay, so the way I've done it is that I have a Google form, and I'm posting it in the chat right now. And all you have to do is fill out that Google form with your name, your net ID, and your position, and if you represent a tier 3 or 4 organization. So 5 minutes is probably more than enough time to do that, I think, Andy.
Actually, to save up on time, let's go ahead and move on. Make sure you click on that link and fill it out before the meeting is over. That way we can have that information.
Right. And if you have any questions, go ahead and message me privately and I'll clarify anything you may have.
Usually the one question that we have is, am I a tier 3 or tier 4 organization? If you don't know what that means, you're probably not.
Yeah.
So that's one of the most common questions. We do have a question from Nicola. Nicola, the minutes are traditionally sent out, they are approved at the next meeting, and we usually don't send those out, but what we do send is a meeting summary, which you can distribute to your constituents, and that will include the PowerPoints, if with permission, the PowerPoints and any information, any links that were listed in the agenda, and that should be within this week, hopefully by tomorrow or Wednesday. Okay. So next on the agenda is the election updates. So as we mentioned before some of you got here, we are gonna have elections next, at the next meeting on September 28th. And there are some pivotal roles that we are missing and we are hoping to elect then. So I'm gonna share briefly, and this will be in the meeting summary. I'll share briefly the list of positions available. So let's see. There you go. And these are it. So all of the executive board positions are available. Please do not be intimidated by the role or the title. Anyone in the GPSA that's a field rep or voting member can run. So the president, my position is available. The executive vice president, and we will send this out. And this briefly summarizes the time commitments, the duties, as well as other responsibilities. If for some reason this document does not answer your questions, feel free to reach out to us. Alexa and I combined have had most of these positions. I was executive vice president before I was president. Alexa was vice president of operations before she was executive vice president.
Communications.
Yes, thank you. Communications. And we can definitely get someone who was a previous president of operations to chime in and let you know what that's about. So again, do not be intimidated by the titles. We actually, it's a role that you learn as you go. Again, so if you have any questions, feel free to email us and we'll list the emails in the chat. So the four executive positions are open: the president, the executive vice president, the vice president of operations, and the vice president of communications. In addition to that, in our standing committees, we do have a vacancy for appropriations chair. And last year we did the byline funding, setting the student activity fee, which is the major role of the appropriations chair. This year should be a calmer year for that position. But it's still very important that we have, because this is how we used to distribute money and sign off on expenditure forms. We do have some vacancies in voting members. I believe in physical science, engineering, master's of engineering, and maybe one more. So if you know of anyone who is interested, feel free to get in touch with Alexa or myself. And field reps. So most of you here are field reps. If there's a department that or you have a friend that wants to really get involved and their department does not have a field representative at one of our meetings, feel free to encourage them to come. And all those are they're not appointed, they are elected by your department. I know my department, we elect those. In addition to that, we have external committees that are outside of the GPSA, and we have been contacted to request members for the Academic Policies and Advising Implementation Committee. So in the document, there is a description of that. We only need one person for that. We also need another GPSA member to serve as the Student Library Advisory Council, as this GPSA representative. And there we also need another GPSA member for the Campus Planning Committee. So again, all the descriptions, fairly detailed descriptions are on the document, which we will send out. The one thing with the CPC, the Campus Planning Committee, is that it does require a 2-year commitment. So that is an elections update. Very briefly, these positions are available. Again, feel free to let us know if you have any questions about what these positions entail. So let me check to see if there are any questions. Thank you, Wendy. So the vacant voting member seats are physical sciences and master student representative in engineering. So I'm gonna go ahead and stop sharing and see if you guys have any questions on that. Okay, I see David, yeah.
Yeah, real quick. So am I to understand correctly that those two voting member positions, is that, are those the only ones that will be open for this year, or are there people who are currently voting members, are they all continuing to remain voting members this year?
Right, that's a great question. So for those of you who were not with the GPSA last year, the new voting members now were elected in May at our second to last meeting. So they're new voting members now. Okay. And they will hold that position all the way until the end of term. The only reason that why we have these positions are because no one ran for them last semester.
Okay, gotcha. So, and real quick, so do those who serve as in an executive capacity, do you also then serve as your field representative too, or does your department also need to send a separate field representative?
That's a great question. I think we can have two roles, but I think you can't serve for more than three roles. So you can't be a tier four representative, field representative, and does that make sense? So I think you can double up, but you can't represent more than one organization. So in that case,
yeah. But basically, if you're the president, you're also the field representative for your department. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. In my case, in my case, we do have a field rep from Romance Studies. For a long time, I was the field rep for Romance Studies. But I have to be here. So I opened it up to give someone else an opportunity. That's a good question.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. You can have that dual role. Absolutely. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Perfect. So now, again, we would recollect ourselves after the division breakout, and we would go straight to the committee Q&A. Usually this is where our different committees that we have, our standing committees in the GPSA, give a brief update of what's going on in their committees, whether that's an event, whether that's anything else that they want the General Assembly to know. For this portion of the meeting, the committee chairs, you will get to know them, and they will give you a very brief overview of what that committee does. All of these committees, we need members for them, so if any of them appeal to you, please reach out to the committee chair, and they will let you know how to get more involved. So our first committee chair is the executive committee, which is Alexa, our executive vice president. And I don't think we have, unless you have some, you have an update, Alexa. Okay, Alexa is probably having issues with her computer. So we'll move on to operations. Operations, we currently don't have a vice president of operations, and this position oversees all the rest of the committees. There's no update on that. And then communications deals with the communications of the GPSA. You would get the email summary from Taylor. So there's no update from communications. And Alexa just confirmed that she unplugged her computer, so she'll be back. Next we have finance. Ariel, did you make it to the meeting?
Yes, I did, actually. we are welcoming new members if you would like to join. So basically what the finance commission does is, you just heard how the appropriations committee sort of breaks up the student activity fee and gives it to the GPSA so we can keep running, and also organizations that are byline funded, things like the Cornell Cinema, that sort of thing. But a lot of the student activity fee that you pay actually is used by student groups, which is awesome. So students actually decide where that money goes, like to which student groups, and GPSA sets those rules. So the Finance Commission is basically the organization that carries out that process. And so we review budgets and we allocate funds to student groups. And it's very interesting because you get to see all of the different events that are happening on campus and clubs that you never knew about. It also does, I think, look good on a resume, I hope. So if you're interested in joining up, please email me at arj66@cornell.edu. And I will post our GPSA FC website link in the chat because that has a lot of useful information on it, including the updates to the guidelines. So just before the semester started, some of you may recall we passed a resolution and there were some temporary 2020-2021 policies that are COVID related that we passed. And we also passed some permanent changes to the guidelines that should hopefully be very clarifying. So I'll post that website link and contact me if you're interested. Thanks very much.
Perfect. Thank you. Next, we'd like to hear from student advocacy. And I do know that Martique is here.
Hi. So I'm the chair of the student advocacy committee. Am I audible with the mask?
You can, perfect.
Okay, so I'm the chair of the student advocacy committee. The official description is it's a committee which works on finances, stipend levels, mental, physical health, childcare, and general well-being of grad students. So it's a lot of things. And with COVID and a lot of things going on campus, there's a need for students overall from all over the campus to be and help me in the student advocacy committee. My email ID is mc2548@cornell.edu. And once we have a committee set up, I'll reach out to everyone and then we can schedule when we want to meet. The idea is to meet once between the two GPSA meetings, and that's pretty much it.
Thank you. So next we'd like to move on to diversity and international students. Yu, did you make it to the meeting? Okay, doesn't seem like it, but diversity and international students is very self-explanatory. It deals with issues with diversity and international students. They've been pretty active in the past, hosting a lot of workshops on equity and in relation to international students. So we'll be looking forward to hearing more from them. Next is programming. Casey, did you make it to the meeting?
Hi, yes. Sorry if it's a little echoey, I'm still in the lab. But yeah, I'm the chair of the programming board. And basically every year we organize non-academic events such as the grad ball or like wine tours and whatnot. So this year will be fairly different and we're not really sure how it will go yet. So we're hoping to meet sometime this week with our new faculty advisor and just get that all settled. But just in general, like the time commitment is that big. There's quite a few of us actually working on it. Ruth is here today. And there's another person I work with, Ronald, who helps me. So if you're interested in joining and helping organizing possibly virtual events, feel free to email me. My email is kml287. So I can write that in the chat to make that easier.
Thank you, Casey. Just a little fun fact about the programming board and the Finance Commission. Last year when we had the issue with COVID, it was very early on. A lot of the money that we donated to the Access Fund came from these two committees. So we're very grateful for them and hope that we can continue to do more work. And next we have faculty awards. And I do know that Cody's here. So hi, Cody.
Oh, yes, I am here. The full name of the committee is the Faculty Teaching, Advising, and Mentorship Award Committee. Those of you that are not familiar with them may not be familiar because they were not held this last year. They normally take place every spring, and they are a really fun way that the GPSA has of sort of honoring faculty members who have really excelled in those areas of teaching, advising, and mentorship. And basically, what happens every year is that you get a chance to read through letters nominating faculty members and sort out, setting out the criteria for what we want to award specifically, and reading through testimonials and deciding on who actually gets the award. It normally takes place over the course of 3 or 4 different meetings. And then there is an award ceremony, which is always really fun. All of the meetings have food. So that's one reason why you should come. I have no idea. I can't promise that. But historically, they all have food. And, you know, otherwise, you just have my charming personality, which is tasty in and of itself. Yeah, so please come join us. It's always, like I said, it's always a lot of fun. It's really inspiring to read through all of these letters and get a chance to see what some of the faculty, you know, some of the wonderful relationships that faculty are able to forge with their students, and just to see, you know, how it's always really inspirational. On a side note, I will definitely need help this year because around that same time this is all going to be happening, I'm going to be having a baby. So so that's going to be busy for me. Yeah, thank you. But yeah, that's it. And I hope you enjoy this presentation. My name, by the way, my email is CJD259. So thank you.
Thank you, Cody, and congratulations. That's awesome. Great. So next we have the general committee. The general committee does not recruit members. We have two representatives, Becca Harrison and Stephanie Lopez, who I don't believe are here, but you will hear an update from them. But they are our GPSA representatives in the general committee. And then next we have our lovely Jan Allen from the grad school, who is always at our meetings, and we love to have her here. So Jan?
I'll just say that the graduate school is still here. We are all continuing to work remotely this fall to de-densify campus, a word that I didn't know existed until recently. But we have staff who start their shift at 6 a.m. and some of them, others go till 10 p.m. And so there's always somebody available. We don't want you to feel like we can't see you, talk to you, and work with you and help you. And I started thinking today of how I could bring chocolate to these meetings, but I'm going to have to get permission from a public health official, because the only idea I came up with is to hide bags of chocolate candy at various locations in Ithaca. And then you go on the Monday of the meetings to those locations and get your stash. But that's got to be cleared as safe. But I miss seeing you guys.
We miss you too, Jen. That would be a fun way to get that chocolate, right? Burn off those calories and and then treat yourself to that treat. Great. And last but certainly not least, we do have, as Gina mentioned in her presentation, a bigger assembly, the university assembly. We do send 4 delegates to the assembly, 4 delegates and the president of the GPSA. And we're not recruiting for that, but it's important for you to know. So if Jeff or any of the other delegates are here and would like to kind of give a brief overview of what happens there, that would be great.
Sure. I don't think anyone else from the UA is here, but so just as Gina and Andy had mentioned, the University Assembly is part of the shared governance structure, and it is a group that has equal representation of not only members of the GPSA, but also the Student Assembly, Faculty Senate, and also the Employee Assembly. And so we typically oversee and give advisory motions for things that kind of affect all members of the Cornell community. And so there hasn't been any real updates since the UA doesn't meet in the summer. We did have a couple of emergency meetings kind of to discuss ongoing things related to reopening campus. And the most recent thing we did in terms of the UA executives was to appoint student, faculty, and staff for the university hearing review boards. So there should be a meeting coming up pretty soon. If anybody wants to attend, let me know, and we can definitely give you the information.
Thank you, Jeff. Great. So I know you heard a little bit, little snapshots of what the committees do. If any of this seems overwhelming or if we're going too fast, we're going to try to send an onboarding document with an FAQ sheet in the meeting summary, or for sure have it in the next agenda for our new members. That way they can read it and understand a little bit better of what the committees are, how funding works. So that is going to come. It's a little outdated. It's the version from last year, which our previous vice president of operations really worked hard on. And she used a software program that I don't have. So we might have to send the outdated version, but it'll just be the outdated is just our positions, which are gonna be replaced with new chairs. Okay, so next we'd like to move on to the next portion of the agenda. We have open forum. And this is where if anyone from the assembly wants to say something and or give an announcement, and I do see, I believe Ariel. Ariel, do you have something to say? The floor is yours.
I just wanted to say that I'm starting a support slash advocacy group for people who have chronic pelvic pain. So I personally have endometriosis, which is, it affects up to 10% of cis women, and it takes on average 7.5 years to diagnose it. So this is really common condition, but it's often misdiagnosed. And part of that reason is that people don't want to talk about their chronic pelvic pain. I'm starting this organization to try and change that. If you have endometriosis, PCOS, IBS, there's a whole bunch of different conditions that can cause chronic pelvic pain. Or if you're just interested in being a really strong ally, please reach out to me at arj66@cornell.edu. Thanks.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Ariel. Anyone else would like to chime in? Okay. Seeing none. Okay. Next, I'd like to move on to the last portion of the agenda. We made it just in time. Adjournment. So does anyone want a motion to adjourn the meeting?
I motion to adjourn the meeting.
Alexa's back with the motion to adjourn the meeting. Is there a second?
Second.
There's been a second. Is there dissent? Okay. Motion passes. The meeting is adjourned. We'll see you guys on September 28th. Thank you to our speakers, Gina, and everyone else. Have a great one.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.